From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross.
Traffic accident? Better call Saul. Injured on the job? Call now. Confess to a homicide? What are you waiting for?
The sleazy, fast-talking lawyer from AMC's Breaking Bad now has a spin-off series called Better Call Saul. On today's Fresh Air, we hear from Bob Odenkirk, who plays Saul Goodman. He says he modeled him on Hollywood's agencies known. He wanted Saul's voice to be like that of Hollywood producer Robert Evans.
With a little melody in it, and that kind of stop and start cliffhanger thing that Robert Evans does when he goes, you know, did I do the right thing? Heck no. Would I do it again? In a second. You know, he leaves you hanging there for just a hair.
And film critic David Edelstein reviews Sponge Out of Water, the new SpongeBob SquarePants movie. That's coming up on today's Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross.
Oh, hello. I was just working on a multi-million-dollar lawsuit for one of my clients. I know what you're thinking. Yeah, a lawsuit sounds good, Saul, but who can I sue? Who can you sue? Try police departments, libraries, construction companies, school officials, cleaning services, financial institutions, local and international, your neighbors, your family members.
That's today's guest, Bob Odenkirk, playing Saul Goodman, the fast-talking attorney starring in his own cheesy TV ads, who was introduced years ago on the AMC drama series Breaking Bad. Odenkirk is revisiting the character in Better Call Saul, a prequel spin-off to Breaking Bad that premieres Sunday and Monday on AMC. But this time, he's the star of the show. And he and the show's creators, Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould, are examining how a low-rent defense attorney named Jimmy McGill came to adopt the swaggering, shifty persona of Saul Goodman. I loved Breaking Bad and love this new show as well. Whether or not you're fluent with Breaking Bad, you should have a great time with Better Call Saul. Here's an early scene from Sunday's opener, which takes place years before the events of Breaking Bad. Odenkirk, as Jimmy McGill, bursts into an Albuquerque courtroom to launch into a passionate defense of his three young clients.
Oh, to be 19 again. You with me, ladies and gentlemen? Do you remember 19? Let me tell you. The juices are flowing. The red corpuscles are corpuscling. The grass is green and it's soft and summer's gonna last forever. Now, do you remember? Yeah, you do. But if you're being honest, I mean, well, really honest, you'll recall that you also had an underdeveloped 19-year-old brain. Me personally, if I were held accountable for some of the stupid decisions I made when I was 19. Oh, boy, wow. And I bet if we were in church right now, you'd get a big amen. Which brings us to these three. Now, these three knuckleheads, and I'm sorry, boys, but that's what you are. They did a dumb thing.
Before playing Saul in Breaking Bad, Odenkirk was best known for two comedy series on HBO. As Gary Shandling's agent on The Larry Sanders Show, and as the co-star and co-creator, with David Cross of Arrested Development, of the sketch series Mr. Show. Terry Gross spoke with Bob Odenkirk in 2013 and opened their conversation by replaying his first appearance on Breaking Bad. It's from Season 2, when Walt and Jesse, played by series stars Bryan Cranston and Aaron Paul, were still small-time meth cookers. The kid who was distributing their meth, Brandon Mayhew, a.k.a. Badger, was busted after selling to an undercover agent. In this scene, Badger is being interrogated at an Albuquerque police station when Saul shows up to represent him.
All right. Who do we have?
Brandon Mayhew.
Brandon Mayhew. All right. Brandon Mayhew. Ah, here we go. Public masturbation.
What?
I don't get it. What's the kick? Why don't you do it at home like the rest of us with a big flat screen TV, 50 channels of pay-per-view, in a Starbucks? That's nice.
That ain't me, man. I was the guy who was selling meth, allegedly.
Okay, all right, I got you. Meth, right. I'm sorry, that was a little transpositional error. Nothing a little whiteout can't take care of. Yeah, and, felony quantity.
Just barely.
Yeah, just barely. The cops around here are like butchers, always got their thumbs on the scales, you know. But good luck arguing that in court. Let me get down to brass tacks. I'm going to get you a second phone call, okay? You're going to call your mommy or your daddy or your parish priest or your Boy Scout leader, and they're going to deliver me a check for $4,650. I'm going to write that down on the back of my business card, okay? 4650, okay? And I need that in a cashier's check or a money order, doesn't matter. Actually, I want it in a money order. And make it out to Ice Station Zebra Associates. That's my loan out. It's totally legit. It's done just for tax purposes. And after that, we can discuss Visa or MasterCard, but definitely not American Express. So don't even ask, all right? Any questions?
What a great start for your character. Bob Odenkirk, welcome to Fresh Air. So we just heard the first scene that you were in Breaking Bad. It's from the second season. What did you know about your character, Saul, when you took the role?
Well, I got a phone call, and my agent said they're going to offer you a role, and you should say yes to this one. And it wasn't like I had been saying no to a lot of roles, but I guess I do say no, maybe more than a few other people. So I said, okay, well, what is it? And he said, it's on Breaking Bad. And at the time, the series was in its second season. It was to appear in the last four episodes of the show. And I said, well, let me check around about this. And I thought I'd call a few friends. I'd seen billboards. First person I called was a writer friend, Reed Harrison, I'd been writing with. I said, do you know anything about this Breaking Bad show? And he goes, that is the best show on TV. You've got to do it. That is awesome. I talked to Vince, and Vince said,
this is Vince Gilligan, the creator.
I said, let me just talk to him. And he goes, he's a sleazy lawyer. His name's Saul Goodman. And I go, well, you know, I'm not Jewish. I said, there's a lot of Jewish actors. I'm sure you could find one. And he goes, oh, no, no, he's not Jewish. He's Irish. He just changed his name to appeal to the homeboys and gain some stature in their eyes. I laughed at that, and I immediately had the idea for the hair, which was my contribution.
Describe it.
Well, it's a comb-over. It is a comb-over that is pretty clearly a comb-over, very obvious.
With a growing bald spot.
Yeah, a growing bald spot, and yet at the same time, somehow a mullet in back. And so it's a tricky little piece of hair engineering that Saul pulls off. But I think it says a lot about his character. Cleaned up on the sides because he's all business. And the comb over is to try to look younger. And the mullet is to try to look like a relaxed dude, but who's also capable of focusing and being serious.
You've said that you based Saul on Hollywood agents more so than on lawyers.
Yeah, I don't know any lawyers.
So what kind of agents do you know who are anything like Saul?
Oh, my God. A lot of them.
Really?
Yeah. They talk really fast. You know, the character wants to get something out of whoever he's talking to. He's trying to manipulate them into doing what he wants. And I think that's true for a lot of agents is they're aware of a certain scenario that they can sell, you know. When they're talking to you, they're pitching you in a clever way on just fitting into a business proposition that they know for some reason that they can sell, which is understandable that that's their motivation. But, you know, you can feel yourself being manipulated or them trying to manipulate you just to make their job work and happen, which is, you know, to make deals.
And of course, you played an agent on Gary Shandling's show. And you used some similar tactics.
Yeah, my first agent is the great Ari Emanuel, who now runs William Morris.
Oh, and he was the basis for, what's his name's character?
Ari Gold.
On Entourage. So he was your first agent?
Yes, and he was my basis for my character on Larry Sanders, Stevie Grant.
Oh.
So Ari's inspired a lot of performances.
Wait. So does this mean that Saul Goodman, the lawyer on Breaking Bad, is kind of 6 degrees of separation from Ari Emanuel? Yeah, really?
Absolutely.
Does Ari Emanuel know that? Does Ari Emanuel's clients know that?
I hope he'd be proud of it. I think he would be proud of it. He likes being noticed, and I think he gets a kick out of his people's estimations of his various talents. He's a great guy. I really like that guy a lot. Also, if I might add, I did an impersonation of Robert Evans, the great film producer, who is such an entertaining guy to hear talk. You know, if you've ever heard his book on tape, The Kid Stays in the Picture, it's incredibly entertaining. And when I saw how many lines I had as Saul, which is a lot more than comedy. In comedy, you'll get like two lines, and then it's a more of a back and forth usually. And Saul Goodman has these long monologues.
Oh, because he's a talker.
He really is a talker. And what he's doing is he's trying to convince you of something. And when he sees that it's not working, he goes another route. Like he switches it up in midstream until he finds the tack that will get him where he wants to go. And when I saw those longs, I thought, you know, I wish I could do some kind of Robert Evans-y type voice with a little melody in it and that kind of stop and start cliffhanger thing that Robert Evans does when he goes, you know, did I do the right thing? Heck no. Would I do it again? In a second. You know, he leaves you hanging there for just a hair, and it makes you listen even closer, you know? And so I thought I'd steal some of that. I don't know how much I did, but I do the character. I do it as Robert Evans, as practice, and then I just do it when I get on stage, in front of the camera, I mean. It's not in a theater yet. Though, right?
I think I have the perfect scene here to illustrate what you just said about Saul, about how he's not selling it one way. He's going to change directions and just try something else. And this is a scene from season 2, episode 8, where Saul's been representing the guy who's been dealing meth for Walt and Jesse, the guy who we heard in the first scene. And Walt and Jesse are really afraid that you're going to let your client talk to the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency. And if he talks, that's going to out Jesse and Walt, and they're going to be in prison. So they can't allow that to happen. So what they've done is they've basically kidnapped you, taken out to the desert. They've dug you a grave, and they're making you kneel, staring into this grave that they've made for you. Meanwhile, they're standing behind you with ski masks on their faces so you can't tell who they are, and they have guns pointed at your back. You have no idea who they are or what they want or why they've captured you. You suspect that they're representatives of one of the Latin drug cartels. Here's the scene. You speak, or shall I say, whimper first, begging for your life.
What can I do for you, gentlemen? Anything, just tell me what you need.
This afternoon, an associate of ours offered you $10,000. You should have taken it.
Wait a minute, this is in regards to what's his name?
Badger. Brandon Mayhew.
The uncle, that was your guy? No offense, guys, but I don't take bribes from strangers. You know, better safe than sorry. That's my motto. But I'll take your money, sure.
Nah, that offer's expired, yo.
Oh, it was kind of low anyways, but okay, I'll take it. Just tell me what you need, all right? I'm easy. I'm going to keep a happy thought and assume this is just a negotiating tactic.
All right. Listen to me very carefully. You're going to give Badger Mayhew the best legal representation ever. But no deals with the DEA. All right? Badger will not identify anyone to anybody. If he does, you're dead.
Why don't you just kill Badger? I mean, follow me, guys, but mosquitoes buzzing around you bite you on the ass. You don't go gunning for the mosquito's attorney. You go grab a fly swatter, I mean, so to speak. I mean, all due respect, do I have to spell this out for you?
We're not killing Badger, yo!
Then you got real problems, okay? Because the DEA is going to come down on your boy like a proverbial ton of bricks. I mean, I don't think I'm going out on a limb here, but hey, he's not going to like prison. He's going to sing like Celine Dion, regardless of what you do to me.
What a great scene. And so my guest Bob Odenkirk as the lawyer Saul, with Aaron Paul as Jesse and Bryan Cranston as Walt in season two from Breaking Bad. And this is how you become their lawyer, because you realize, mm-hmm. like, the way to play this is to tell them, like, you have to tell me everything. I'll help you, but first you have to make me your lawyer by officially paying me. So just, like, put a dollar in my pocket. I'm your lawyer. Now we have attorney-client privilege. You can say anything, and I'm going to help you, and you don't have to kill me. So
yeah,
a brilliant, brilliant strategy.
Great, fun scene. We were in the desert at 2 a.m. in a sandstorm in the middle of nowhere, and it was freezing, too. It was like 40 degrees. And
which is good, because you should be shaking with fear.
Yeah, it was quite an experience and made me happy to be in show business.
Bob Odenkirk speaking to Terry Gross in 2013 about his role as Saul Goodman in Breaking Bad. His new show, Better Call Saul, a prequel to Breaking Bad, premieres on AMC with two episodes Sunday and Monday.
You're the most comic character in a show that's about really, like, horrible and often tragic things and, you know, really terrible people.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there's some comic elements in the rest of it, but your character is, like, so funny. What's it like being, like, the comic character in plots where everything is always going wrong? People are getting killed and getting addicted and getting lied to and so on.
It's fun. Yeah. I'm glad to bring that tone to the show. I love making wisecracks, and in that way I'm impersonating my father. That's how I look at it, who made a lot of jokes and cynical wisecracks all the time. It's how the character's written. I don't improvise a single word that I say as Saul. In fact, it's been a fun challenge for me to not add anything, but to rather try to deliver the material exactly the way it's written, literally word for word. I come close. I don't nail it, but I come real close. But also, until the last season, the one that we're in the middle of right now, Saul is a bit, he's got all the danger at arm's length, which is how he likes it. The people around him may be under threat of death or arrest, prison, but he himself will never be in the crosshairs. And so it's kind of a game to him, you know. He manipulates these pieces on the chessboard trying to make as much money in the end for himself as he can. And it's a laugh to him. You know, when Jesse gets beat up by Hank and ends up in the hospital, Saul walks in and immediately starts making wisecracks about Jesse's appearance, you know, telling Walt, you know, you're the pretty one now. Ringo, meet Paul. Paul, Ringo, you know, and it's all a big joke, you know, because Saul's not going to get beat up by anyone. In the fifth season, Saul jokes a little less, but he still makes wisecracks, but not quite so many, because he really is scared and he's really become aware of how dangerous Walt is, because Walt is a lot more dangerous than you think he is when you meet him.
So the writing is so good on Breaking Bad. And like with your character, with Saul, there's something so not only kind of like comic and wordy, but almost flowery about the way he speaks. Like he has his guns pointed at his back. He's overlooking his grave in the scene that we just heard. And he's calling them gentlemen. Like, like Walt and Jesse, who have guns on him. And he's saying, like, with all due respect, do you love the kind of almost like old fashioned flowery way he has?
I do. It's fun to talk like that. It's fun to have a character who's that verbose. And to me, it's all a form of sleight of hand, but it's sleight of speech. And believe me, when I got the first script and there were these long speeches, and I thought, just coming from comedy, I thought, well, when they rewrite the speech, you know, the final draft is going to be just a short line. It'll just be a line saying, I can't help you, you know. And then I got the rewrites, the blue pages, because they're printed on blue paper, about 5 days before I shot the first scene. And literally one word had been changed in all those speeches. And it made me go, okay, well, now what's really going on here? Why did the writers think that my character needs to talk this much? And then that's when I started taking apart those speeches and seeing that there's often a line of logic that Saul is following, and then he's finding it a dead end, and he has to go another direction. So it's all about manipulating the person he's talking to.
Bob Odenkirk speaking to Terry Gross in 2013. His new series, Better Call Saul, premieres Sunday and Monday on AMC. It's a prequel to the same network's Breaking Bad. In that series, Odenkirk played Saul Goodman, the sleazy lawyer who was one of criminal Walter White's co-conspirators. In this new prequel, Better Call Saul, set a few years before Breaking Bad, Odenkirk plays Jimmy McGill, a young, struggling attorney who will, in time, become Saul Goodman.
In your office on Breaking Bad, there's a large, blown-up copy of the Constitution on your back wall. Describe your office.
Well, it has a facade that I sit in front of these Roman columns that are made of styrofoam. And later in episodes, Saul actually moves the columns to side.
Because he's trying to see if the place is bugged.
Yes, you can see they weigh nothing and they're just total facade. And then in the shape of a, you know, in an oval shape, I suppose to invoke the Oval Office or something, is the half oval behind him with the Constitution on it and the pillars around it. But you may think that is a ludicrous setup, but Rob Wilson King is the set decorator who designed that office. And when I walked into it, I was like, wow, this is a strong choice here. And he said, well, we went around to some local offices and we were inspired by them. And this is what we came up with. And I thought, there's no one goes this far, do they? And then last year, I was riding down Central in Albuquerque. I like to ride bikes around any city I'm in. It's a great way to see things and move kind of quickly. And I passed a replica of the White House. You know, it's got like eight lawyers in. It's called the White House. And it's a miniature kind of, White House, but only not.
I want to play another scene that you're in as Saul Goodman on Breaking Bad. And this is a scene where things have gone really bad. Walt has been beaten by the drug lord he works for, Gus, and now he's afraid for his life and for the lives of his wife and children. So he rushes into your office to take you up on an idea that you'd previously suggested for a way out. You speak first.
What the hell happened to you? What you...
Saul, this man that we spoke of before, this person that you said could disappear me, give me a whole new life, and make sure that I'm never found.
Yeah,
I need him. Saul, Gus is gonna murder my whole family.
Oh, Christ.
I need this man now. Saul! Now, Saul!
Yeah. You understand there's no coming back from this. I mean, you're gonna get new socials, new identities. You can't contact your friends or relatives ever again.
All right. Yes, I understand.
How are you gonna sell this to that wife of yours and your teenage son?
I have got no choice.
You're wanted by some pretty scary individuals, not to mention the law. You're a high-risk client. You're gonna need the deluxe service. It's gonna cost you.
How much?
The last quote I got on the deluxe was 125 grand, but you got four people to vanish. It's gonna be at least half a million, and he accepts cash only.
I've got the money. Now, come on,
please.
Here. Okay. But this is a vacuum cleaner repair company.
What'd you expect? Haji's quick vanish? I don't even know the guy's name. You just call that number and you leave a message. You tell him that you need a new dust filter for a Hoover Max Extract Pressure Pro Model 60. I wrote it right on there. He'll call you back in 5 minutes.
Okay, fine. How long does it take for him to arrange?
The guy works fast. I mean, that's the game here. You got to have your family packed and ready to go before you make the call. He'll tell you where to meet him. He'll put you up in a safe house until everything is set, but you got to bring the money. He doesn't lift a finger unless he's paid in full.
Okay.
Wow. A great scene with my guest Bob Odenkirk and Bryan Cranston from Breaking Bad. I love it when, like, you know, Walt comes in, he's telling you that, like, his wife and children are in jeopardy, you know, that Gus might have them killed, and you go, Christ. It's like, oh, now what?
Yeah, well, you know, Saul's just thinking, oh, this thing's gone to the dogs now, this great...
More work
for me.
I
think when he, yeah. when he met Walt, he thought, this is my golden calf here. I'm going to be rich off this. This is what I've been waiting for. And he's going to handle himself, and he's not going to do anything crazy, and it's going to be great. And so that's the oh Christ, too, is Saul's realizing, like, this is just like every other thing he's tried. It's this guy can't keep it together.
What have you learned from working with actors like Bryan Cranston?
I think a lot of sketch comedians and certainly stand-up comics who occasionally perform feel kind of embarrassed about taking acting seriously. They think of acting as something that they'd be embarrassed to admit they made an effort at, you know? And I think that being around actors who come from an acting craft background, like Aaron Paul and Bryan Cranston, don't feel any embarrassment at all about making an effort and taking the time and prepping for their part and trying to get in a headspace to play that. And I've been in scenes where I've seen Aaron Paul take, you know, 5 minutes to get himself worked into an emotional state of intensity and anxiety and sadness and fear, and get himself there in a physical way in order to play the scene. And that's just something that comic actors and the people that I come out of would kind of, they'd probably make fun of that.
Tell us something about your childhood, where you grew up, what you were known for among friends in school.
Well, I am from Naperville, Illinois, and from a family of seven kids, and they're a funny group of people. All of them are funny. My brother Bill is a writer of The Simpsons. He's been for about 10 years. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we were far away from the world of show business in Naperville. And so it took me a long time to imagine even that I could be a part of this. But it's a very funny group of people, and there was a lot of good times and a lot of laughter in our house and a lot of impersonations of people that we'd met that day. And it's a mostly Irish, some German Catholic family, and my mother is very funny, though she doesn't really know it. She's makes a lot of wisecracks all through her day, and she laughs a lot. And my father was kind of a good joker too, although he liked to tell like bar jokes, and when I was young, he liked hee-haw, which escaped me.
Did he actually like tell jokes?
Yeah, he told jokes, you know, like you pick up in a bar.
Yeah, do you remember any of the jokes he told?
I don't. I never liked them. I never liked the jokes. My dad, I didn't like that much either, but I tolerated him.
So when you became a comic, having had your father tell a lot of jokes,
but not my kind
jokes.
Of jokes.
Yeah, exactly. Like, so what did that make you want to turn to when you become a comic?
Well, nothing consciously. It's just I just did what I did. I didn't think about that, except I always felt like comedy was about honesty, you know, and somehow saying how you really feel about things, you know, because for me, it's about getting to the core of things and speaking honestly about hypocrisy and stuff. But there was a kind of comedy I saw a lot of when I was a kid that was almost the opposite. It was like this strange kind of covering up of genuine motivation. All those Bob Hope specials just made me cringe when I was a kid. You never found them funny, and all the sexual innuendo just made me crazy, even though as a child I didn't know what sex was about, but I just remember watching and thinking, why don't you just say you're horny, you know, instead of rolling your eyes? What a weird thing. We all know what you mean. You know, it just seemed dishonest in a strange way. and I didn't know why anyone would find it funny. When I found Monty Python, that's what really spoke to me.
Bob Odenkirk speaking to Terry Gross in 2013. He stars in Better Call Saul, the prequel to Breaking Bad, that premieres Sunday and Monday on AMC. But long before that, he got his first big break off camera as a writer for NBC's Saturday Night Live.
Was it ever frustrating for you at Saturday Night Live to, you know, to be on it and yet not really be known? You weren't a performer.
Yeah. Absolutely. I always knew I wanted to perform. In a lot of ways, I became a writer so that I could perform. And I also knew that when I got hired at Saturday Night Live that I was nowhere near ready to perform on a national stage and with that much scrutiny. And after 4 years of writing there, I was no nearer to it either, even though every summer I would perform. And I told Lorne, and I said, I have to leave because I want to be a performer and I have to go get good at that. And, I don't know if he cared one way or the other what my excuse was. It was hard. It was hard because it was, I love performing and it was a little unsatisfying no matter how well it went for me on any one week at Saturday Night Live. It was unsatisfying to not get to do what I'd written or, you know, be a part of it in that way. I knew I had to go. And, I wish I'd been a more effective writer at Saturday Night Live. And there's certainly plenty that's been spoken about that place and written about it. But it was a great place for me to learn and try to become, a little bit more socially adept, because I was incredibly awkward when I got hired there. And
what was your problem?
I had a huge chip on my shoulder.
What do you mean?
I was really cynical about people, and I was a difficult guy, and I probably didn't communicate that well. So it's already a difficult place to work, and there's already a ton of pressure, and it didn't help that I wasn't the most pleasant person to work with. I mostly worked with Robert Smigel and some with Conan O'Brien, and I did make friends over the years, and I did become a more effective writer towards the end. But I needed to leave there and, I think, do the things that were motivating me, like performing and writing my own sketches.
Did It's Gary Shandling's show come after that?
It did. I was a writer and an actor on the Ben Stiller show that was produced by Judd Apatow and Ben, and all my friends were in that show, Ben, Janine Garofalo, Andy Dick. That was a great, great joy and fun to work on. And Gary Shandling was one of the celebrity guest actors or performers, whatever. He came in. The Ben Stiller show was linked up with these interview pieces, and Gary came in, so he knew us. And I went and auditioned to play the agent on his show. And because he knew me, I think that helped me have a leg up and to play the part of Stevie Grant on Larry Sanders.
Let's hear a clip from the Larry Sanders show in which you played Larry Sanders' agent. Of course, the Larry Sanders show starred Gary Shandling as late night TV host Larry Sanders, who hosts a show kind of like The Tonight Show. And as his agent, you've been representing him for years, but now Larry's been under fire from the network. He's insecure about the future. You've been hedging your bets while you're negotiating for his contract by also signing one of his potential rivals, Jon Stewart, who is played by Jon Stewart. So in this scene, you're backstage with Larry Sanders, Gary Shandling, right before he's about to step on stage to tape his late night show. And you're discussing the negotiations.
Hey, there you are. Sorry I'm late. I was at a photo shoot.
Oh, for which client?
No, it was for me. It was for Entertainment Weekly, the 50 most powerful people in Hollywood under 30.
I thought you were 32.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
So, did you talk to the network?
Oh, you mean did I kick the shit out of them and stuff their head in a toilet and flush it 19 times? Yeah.
And?
1 year, no bump.
How many times did you flush your head down the toilet?
What are you trying to say?
What do you mean?
Well, it just sounds like you're trying to imply that I didn't do my best.
This is about Jon Stewart, isn't it? I am telling you, ABC has just made him an offer, and the network is just using me as a negotiation tool. Who represents him anyway?
I do.
You do?
Yeah.
Since when?
Since today.
I thought you had a photo shoot and a meeting.
I had to eat lunch, Larry.
With Jon Stewart?
Yeah.
I see. Don't you think that's a tad of a conflict?
Not for me. Hey, that's what life is about, Larry. It's about conflict. Yeah, you have to learn to balance things out, right? You know, and I think I do a pretty good job.
No. Excuse me. I have to go be on television.
That's Gary Shandling and my guest Bob Odenkirk in a scene from the Larry Sanders Show. Bob Odenkirk plays Saul Goodman, the lawyer on Breaking Bad. People like your character so much that you were on a recent cover of The New Republic. And
yeah.
The cover was for a story about how big law firms are having a hard time making big money now. And so
Yes. There's
a picture of you on the cover in your full Saul Goodman persona. And the caption reads, "Are you downwardly mobile, terrified of your colleagues, unsure of what your kids look like, realizing that after selling your soul for the promise of a cushy life, your whole field is going to hell? You must be an attorney." And I'm wondering if you get a lot of reactions to Saul from lawyers, and if they like your character or if they're offended by your character.
I've heard more than once people say, I got to tell you, I know lawyers like Saul, which is always funny to me because it occurs to me that maybe they mean to say they're like Saul or not me, but all the other guys in this profession.
So one more question. When people see you on the street, people who are fans
mm-hmm.
of Breaking Bad,
yes.
What do they say to you? Is there a commonly said thing?
Well, they all say, "Better call Saul."
Yeah.
But some of them, this is so weird, Terry.
Yeah.
And this is like, I think this is because it's so much more famous than anything I've done. It's so much bigger. There's like fringe awareness of the show, where people know the show, know the characters on the show, but they've probably not really seen it, or they've only seen a few minutes of it. So this is where we trip into the weird place of sort of a version of success or fame that that is so strange. I get this. I got it today on the way into this building. I get this. I'm going to shout this out, so I'm going to back away from the mic.
Okay.
Sal! Okay, so that guy, this has happened more than once. That guy doesn't know my name, only knows me from Breaking Bad, but doesn't know Breaking Bad that well, and has seen it enough to know I play I don't look like the character, so he knows it well enough to recognize my face, even though he doesn't know the show that well. That's a weird place to get to. He doesn't know the name of the character, so he hasn't watched the show that closely. But he knows it well enough to recognize my face even without the hair pieces in and the suit and all that other stuff.
So what do you say in response?
I go, uh-huh.
And then keep walking?
And I keep walking.
Thank you
so
much for talking with
us.
It's really been a pleasure.
I appreciate it.
Bob Odenkirk speaking to Terry Gross in 2013. His new series, Better Call Saul, premieres Sunday and Monday on AMC. In 1999, Nickelodeon launched the cartoon series SpongeBob SquarePants, created by animator and former marine biologist Steven Hillenburg. The sea sponge and his starfish, squid, snail, and other friends have now appeared in over 100 shorts and 2 feature films. The second, the SpongeBob movie, Sponge Out of Water, opens this week. Film critic David Edelstein plunged in eagerly and has this review.
A decade ago, I got a dream newspaper assignment to fly to L.A. and talk to Steven Hillenburg and his colleagues about turning their Nickelodeon smash SpongeBob SquarePants into a feature film. On TV, the SpongeBob cartoons were 11 minutes, the perfect length of time to be bombarded by free-form, surreal gags, interspersed by the high-pitched chortles of their happy-go-lucky sea sponge hero. But a full-length movie? Hillenburg was sure that the same level of intensity, over 80 minutes, would wear the audience out, that a feature needed a more conventional narrative arc and more even pacing. And you know what? He was wrong. The SpongeBob SquarePants movie, released in 2004, had delightful bits and a killer soundtrack, but it was too smooth, too stately. That story structure was like an anchor weighing it down. What I missed were those free associational spasms of craziness that make SpongeBob at its best so irrationally entertaining. Now comes the second feature, the SpongeBob movie Sponge Out of Water, which looks as if it had a lower budget. The narrative is slipshod, shambolic, nonsensical. The few song fragments are punishingly discordant. It's visually an eyesore, a kaleidoscope of bright, mismatched colors, and in 3D, too, to make your headache even stronger. It's a big, loud, choppy, hit-and-miss, in-your-face, glorious triumph. Bang. They hit the bullseye. It begins, as all SpongeBob episodes do, with a hairy pirate who's there to sing the theme that whisks us to the undersea world of Bikini Bottom with its ukulele music and flower cloud backdrops. But wait, here he's live action and played by Antonio Banderas, and he's on an Indiana Jones-like quest to find a magic book. After dueling with a skeleton and shushing some card-playing seagulls, the pirate reads aloud from that mysterious tome, a story of wholesale destruction, societal collapse, apocalypse, all triggered by the loss of the recipe for the wildly addictive Krabby Patties from the Krusty Krab restaurant where SpongeBob works and his best friend Patrick, the fat, pink, dim-witted starfish, eats. I know what you're thinking. This has something to do with Plankton, the tiny but very loud owner of the rival Chum Bucket restaurant. And you'd be right, to an extent. Plankton did engineer a scheme involving pickle torpedoes, a giant robot, and a Trojan horse-like coin to get into the Krusty Krab's safe. I have a feeling I'm losing you. The best thing about this movie is that it can't be explained. Though you can hear how high the stakes are when Mr. Crab straps Plankton down and, with SpongeBob watching, uses diabolical means to recover the recipe.
Mr. Krabs, I'm telling you, he's innocent.
What are you going to do, Krabs? Pour hot oil on me? Or put bamboo shoots under my nails?
No. Knock, knock.
Knock, knock, jokes. I can do this all day, Krabs.
Knock, knock.
Oh, boy. Who's there?
Jimmy.
Jimmy who?
Jimmy, back my formula, Plankton!
Well, that's stupid, but how is it torture?
You'll see.
Jimmy, back my formula.
Oh, I get it!
Stop, Krabs! Make it stop!
The two main characters in SpongeBob Out of Water aren't, as usual, SpongeBob and his buddy Patrick, but SpongeBob and the arch-villain Plankton, who's forced to team up despite being so selfish he can't pronounce the word team. They build a time machine. They morph into another dimension. They transform into Marvel-like superheroes. But never mind the plot. The point is that Tom Kenny's SpongeBob voice, which sounds like Pee-wee Herman meets Jerry Lewis on helium, pairs beautifully with the Plankton of an actor who calls himself Mr. Lawrence and sounds like an over-caffeinated Fred Flintstone. I was recently reading a book on how to write that had tricks to get your juices flowing, like opening a random book to a random page and picking three random words. Could that explain how the filmmakers came up with the extraterrestrial bottlenose dolphin whose Shakespearean orations are broken by chatters and whose job it is to keep the planets Jupiter and Saturn from colliding? Don't see the SpongeBob movie Sponge Out of Water if you don't want to be driven crazy by questions like that. But I'm going to see it again this weekend. I long for that craziness. It's like a Krabby Patty for the brain.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. On the next Fresh Air, Michael Keaton talks about starring in Birdman. He's been nominated for an Oscar for his performance. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.B. Nesper. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.
Comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing online access to service ratings and reviews so customers can find local plumbers, landscapers, HVAC professionals, house cleaners, and other services. Learn more at angieslist.com. And from care.com, offering HomePay, a solution for nanny payroll, tax, and HR obligations, from automatic payments to preparing state and federal tax returns. Learn more at care.com/NPR.